The vast amount of information available out about the Civil War can be pretty daunting for someone who would like to learn more about it, but maybe not go into huge detail. We have our next guest who's with us online. Tom Flagle is an assistant professor of history at Columbia State Community College in Franklin, Tennessee, and is the author of The History Buff's Guide to the Civil War. And he's taken a different approach that I'm really finding interesting. And just to let you know, I was looking at my library of Civil War books last night. Oh, there's more than 100 there. And I've read all of them. And I tell you what, as I looked through this book, I thought, oh man, I wish I'd had this book when I first started reading about the Civil War, because it would have made my life a whole lot easier. He's done a very interesting approach, is to make it more easily understandable and digestible. He's broken it down into large headings. He's got headings like politics and military life and the home front. But then he makes top 10 lists under these headings. And I find it really effective. So great to have him with us today. And certainly, if you have questions about the Civil War, about his book, I hope you'll join in. Have you read a lot of books about the Civil War? Are you a Civil War buff? What attracts you to this period in our history? Maybe you're planning some special trips. He has some information on trips, and my wife and I have made a couple of those trips and really got a lot out of it. And I looked, and there it is in the back of his, toward the back of his book. So join in with your own questions or comments, be it visiting sites or the Civil War itself. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post your comment or question there. And let's see if we have Tom Flagle. Tom, are you there?
Yes, Larry. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I'm really enjoying it. I'm going to admit to you that I have not finished the entire book, but I've read big parts of it. And I'm really enjoying this way that you've broken it down. How did you decide on this model?
Well, actually, I'd had a lot of readers and students who asked me how to get involved in the Civil War. You're exactly right. There's over 50,000 books on the war, and many of them were, I found, to be something in the neighborhood of 1,000 pages each, oftentimes drowning me in minutia, and it's my job to know this stuff. And then there's others that are so light and fluffy that I never really got the big picture. And so I was reading an article once on the top 10 oil spills in history, the worst ones. And I was just assuming, well, Exxon Valdez has got to be at the top. And I find out it didn't even make the top 10. I instantly learned about spills off Trinidad and Tobago and off Spain that were 8 times worse. And so this light bulb went off. What a great way to look at history, using comparison and contrast, because oftentimes we just know one or two famous names or dates or events, but we don't know them in their true context, just like me with the Exxon Valdez. And so I started writing this book with that top 10 list idea.
Well, it's I tell you what, and it's had to have been, in some ways, quite a bit harder. Now, you've written about the Civil War in other books. It must have almost been harder to write this book than, say, what you might call a more, quote-unquote, conventional book.
It was difficult but liberating at the same time.
Ah.
I realized I only had to do top 10, but the idea of actually getting down to the top 10, the more subjective ones, like top 10 best generals or top 10 heroines, those were difficult because I had to really cut down and look at the criteria I wanted to use. What is measurable? How they use their time, their resources, that sort of thing. Some of the other things were a little bit more easy to calculate. For example, the top 10 deadliest Civil War prisons or the top 10 ways soldiers died. That was a difficult thing in itself. But ironically, it's how much I taught myself during the process of writing the whole thing. Many of the times, my hypotheses were well off because I didn't really actually start digging into the statistical elements of the war until this book.
Oh, well, it's great. We already callers online to visit with you. And before we go to the Terry, we'll get to you in just a second from Green Bay. There were things that I right away in the beginning, the causes of the Civil War. Now, I can remember, I've read so many different treatises. I was thinking back to Shelby Foote's. I read all 3,000 whatever odd pages of his books, and I've read so many others. I was really interested in how you, what you came up with for causes of the Civil War, because you took, for example, Southern dependence on slavery, which, as you know, people have kind of poo-pooed that, but that really was an important part of the reason for the war.
Certainly so, and I usually like to get rid of the term slavery, as difficult as that may be, and use it and call it instead cheap labor. We Americans have always been addicted to cheap labor and will do almost anything to get it. That was one of those cases. Well, slavery wasn't that huge until the Industrial Revolution, and with it, the demand for cotton and textiles. At one point, one quarter of all jobs in the Northeast United States were directly or indirectly tied with textiles. Well, we needed the raw material. And so with the cotton gin and expansion of the United States in the South, we had it, and we had a huge dependency on slave labor. There's only 1 million, only 1 million slaves in the United States in 1800. By 1860, there were 4 million, and the United States heavily depended on it. But Southerners, a handful did, for their social, economic, and political control. They really dominated Southern and indeed national politics through slavery. It wasn't just an income. It was a leverage, and they couldn't stand any concept of any threat to it.
Well, it was like a third of their, I think I was trying to remember what you said about a third of their wealth it constituted.
Yes. In the 1860s, in the 1860 census, the United States had about $1 billion worth of gold in infrastructure, roads, bridges, harbors, that sort of thing. But they had $2 billion invested in human beings. 57% of the population of South Carolina was human property, if you will. 54%, or about 55% in Mississippi was human property. In some counties in Mississippi, 19 out of 20 people belonged to somebody else. This was a phenomenal investment.
Oh, man. And as you point out, and as the states joined, the southern states joined in, they joined in almost or maybe directly as depended a little bit on the number of slaves that were in the state.
It's so much about percentage. The higher percentage, the more likely they were going to leave. South Carolina, number one, they were the number one to leave. Mississippi, number two, they were number two to leave. The bottom four out of the 15 slave states, as far as percentage goes, didn't leave. It wasn't necessarily anything else than that particular preoccupation. And I must emphasize this. Many people say, and they are totally right, that many people in the South didn't fight for slavery, and many Northerners didn't fight to liberate slaves. That is entirely true. And I need to emphasize this point. What causes a war and what motivates young men to go fight in it are oftentimes two completely different narratives.
Yeah.
For example, only one out of 10 Confederate slaves, only one out of 10 Confederate soldiers owned a slave, but 98% of the delegates in Montgomery, Alabama, who announced this new country called the Confederate States, 98% of them owned slaves. Yeah. And they wrote a constitution that used the word slavery 10 times. They knew what they were doing.
Hmm. Terry in Green Bay is up with a question or comment. Terry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask a question. Recently, an older gentleman I know has a book on the Civil War. And I'm sorry, I'm not at home right now, so I can't tell you what the author of the book is, but it's quite a large book. It's not real thick, but it's about roughly 18, I'm guessing, by 22 inches. It's maps of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
mm-hmm.
wondering if your guest is familiar with something like that, and if there would be a value. You know, it's just a huge book.
There's several atlases. If it's relatively longish, it might be the West Point Atlas on the Civil War. That one actually has been criticized over the years for being relatively inaccurate. And yet there are new atlases that have been coming out left and right that are just absolutely phenomenal, going back and looking at the battles themselves and trying to look through official records and reports and trying to find out exactly where units were. More than likely, if it's old, it's probably, believe it or not, inaccurate, but it might have some collective value. If it's newer, it's going to be available almost anywhere, but it will be more dependable, especially if it's a university publisher.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Betty in Oak Creek next. Hi, Betty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband's grandfather fought in the Civil War.
Wow.
And he enlisted out of Burlington, Wisconsin on September the 11th of 1863, and he mustered out in Texas at 1866 at Brownsville. And from the time he mustered out until the time he got married, and that was, he married a lady that was half his age. So.
Oh, yes, that was very common.
She was 26, and he was 52, I think, or 54, and they had six children, and, of course, my father-in-law was one of the children. I have a little bit of information. My husband doesn't seem to be too interested, and, of course, they never talked about anything growing up, apparently.
That's very common. Veterans of many wars. I tend to say history doesn't repeat itself. Human behavior does. And I find out that it is extremely common that veterans of this war and other wars don't talk about the event. So don't be surprised by that. They will talk about that to fellow veterans, but they almost never talk to it about the war to their family members. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but continue. It's fascinating.
He actually ended up in Missouri, and that's where he was married. And between the time he mustered out in Texas and when he got married in Missouri at 1886, it says here, we don't know any information about him between those, that time frame. Now, someone said, once in the Civil War you got mustered out, say in Texas, you found your own way home. Is that true?
That was extremely common for Confederate soldiers because their infrastructure had been, for the most part, devastated, as well as their money. Northern soldiers often had the opportunity to take steamboats back or rail lines back, especially military confiscated lines. So it was easier for them to make it back. But if he was deep in the heart of Texas, as this individual was, it would have been a long, long process. It's entirely possible he had to go by way of the Gulf of Mexico first and then up the Mississippi, or try to make his way over to Baton Rouge, where there was a handful of rail lines still operating. But yes, I think one of the more amazing things about this war is the lack of connection, exactly as you're saying. My son serve in Kuwait, and I was able to talk to him. I mean, talk to him almost every day, whereas these soldiers are oftentimes away from home and would not receive or send a letter for months. The ache of not knowing must have been amazing.
It must have been. And I want to talk with you some more about those letters as well, because the soldiers didn't really realize that people were sending the mail and they just weren't getting it. It's an interesting part of it, and we'll take it up with our guest, Tom Flagel, author of History Buff's Guide to the Civil War, right after a look at the news. Great to have you with us here on The Ideas. Nat, Larry Mueller here talking today with Thomas Flagel, Assistant Professor of History at Columbia State Community College in Franklin, Tennessee, and is the author of The History Buff's Guide to the Civil War and other titles as well. Top 10 rankings of the best, worst, largest, most lethal people and events of the Civil War. It's fascinating reading, and I hope you'll join in if you have some questions or comments for him as we move along today. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, and all of our lines are filled right now, so let's just go right to the phones and to Claire in Oconomowoc. Claire, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I have a couple questions if you have time. I'm wondering what the top 10 Civil War sites to visit are, and I wonder if you have a top 10 reasons why the North won the war.
Okay. Tom Flagel?
Yes, that's one of those situations I'm thinking, should I actually tell her or force her to buy the book? Number one, I actually, as far as places to visit, I list as Gettysburg. It is really full of tourists, of course, a phenomenal amount of memorials and monuments, but even on its most crowded day, it is amazing, and please take more than one day. They have a brand new $100 million Civil War visitor center there. I've had the pleasure of speaking there several times, and it is just absolutely amazing. They have essentially the most beautiful statement I've ever heard about Gettysburg is it's been called the mausoleum of our patriot dead, and this applies for both North and South. It has the ironic thing about Gettysburg is that it really ironically doesn't decide much in the war. Technically, it was a tie, and many historians have been noticing that right now. But it was the largest, deadliest war ever to be fought in the northern western continents of the Americas. It's phenomenal. And so please go there, and it is amazing. Second most, I really encourage you to see Antietam, and that is not far away. I also heavily, heavily endorse Shiloh, which is in southwest Tennessee of my new adopted state. Shiloh is beautiful in that there's very little development around it, so you can still get lost and picture the battle. But again, I encourage you to buy the book, and I also encourage you to look. Ironically, this country owns this war more than any other war. Even the American Revolution, that's essentially an East Coastal element. But the American Civil War, you can travel and actually see hundreds of sites, not just a few dozen.
We, my wife and I, took a vacation, and we went first to Antietam, and we stayed overnight at the Piper House, which is a bed and breakfast right on the grounds, and where Longstreet, it was the same building where he held had his headquarters during Antietam.
Right.
And then drove to Gettysburg. And I mean, you're absolutely right. And one of the things I just wanted to mention, we've sort of found by accident while we were at Gettysburg that there were many. There are experts that give sort of tours of various points of the battle, and those are free. You show up, and they'll take you. For example, we walked across the battlefield. Where we took Pickett's Charge walk and walked the battlefield. And it was just a fascinating, kind of eerie in some ways, trek.
As Barbara Tuchman says, if you really want to know an historic place, you have to go to the place. And there's something about walking Pickett's Charge of nearly a mile across and coming across that wall of stones and realize what happened there. And also, I think it's a valuable trip for Wisconsinites. Six regiments from Wisconsin fought there and suffered horribly. The Iron Brigade that involved several Wisconsin regiments suffered so badly, they essentially fought themselves out. The state of Wisconsin alone has the seventh worst state losses, more so than Virginia at Gettysburg, 37%. Of men from the Badger State at Gettysburg were either killed, wounded, captured, or missing in the course of 3 days.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing figures. Well, the other part she mentioned was sort of a top 10 list of the reasons why the North won the Civil War.
And indeed, I kind of leave that up to my reader.
Yeah.
I have that actual list in my World War II book, but in the Civil War, I leave it up to the reader, and it becomes evident quickly that it is so much a matter of 1,000 different variables.
Yeah.
The United States depended on nobody more than itself before the Civil War. Number one trading partner for the North was the South, and vice versa. But the North could produce one ship 10 times faster than the Confederacy. For every engineer in the South, there were six in the North. For every gun made in the South, there could be 30 made in the North. Indeed, 80% of Robert E. Lee's doctors were trained in Pennsylvania. Just materially, the South just didn't have the ability to fight on. They were outpopulated essentially 4-1 because 40% of their population was slaves. And I think the biggest factor was that the North had a president that would not stop.
Yeah.
He would find new ways to fund the war. We actually got the national income tax invented during the war to pay for the whole thing. I'm glad that hasn't bothered us since, and we go into a massive amount of debt. And then in 1864, he gets reelected and promises never to stop.
Frank in Milwaukee, we turn to you now. Hi, Frank.
Hello there. Thanks for the lovely program. I appreciate it so much. I just wondered what your opinion was of the Doris Kearns Goodwin, A Team of Rivals book. I've read it twice, and I love the book. But it's such a love letter, and it puts Lincoln on such a plateau. I mean, he wouldn't kick his dog. He was just perfect personally as well as a president. Now, he did make mistakes, of course, and judgment, but it's such an honorific look at him. Obviously, you've probably read the book. What do you think of it?
Frank, 100% in agreement. Doris Kearns Goodwin has always been a fascinating storyteller, really has got the ability to bring people into the place and time. She's an excellent researcher, and I think one of the best biographies on Lyndon Baines Johnson comes from her. But I agree completely. She's not here to defend herself. But to call Abraham Lincoln a genius, nobody would disagree with that sooner than Lincoln himself. If you have a 500,000 dead, Americans dead by the end of your first term, you're not a genius. If you cannot avoid the war to begin with, you're not a genius. If you have the national debt increase 4,200% during your administration, and no president has ever seen that kind of increase, ever, you are not a genius. And indeed, the North and South takes decades. It isn't a handshake at Appomattox. It's generations that re-heals this country. And nobody, again, would agree that with your statement sooner than Abraham Lincoln. A great example being, for his Secretary of War, he picks Pennsylvania politico Cameron, who is an incompetent,
yeah.
And Lincoln sticks with him for nearly a year.
Yeah.
This is not the work of a genius. But again, that was Lincoln's strength. He knew he wasn't the brightest man, but he also had a diligence and tenacity, the likes of which I've rarely seen before or since.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank, for calling. Glady in Decorah, Iowa, we're on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. We have a family member who was a Civil War battle nurse,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just wondering how I can research as to where she went. Her husband signed up for the service, and she said she was going with, and I know what regiment he was with.
Was it in Iowa?
No, it was in Illinois.
Okay.
Which regiment was that, by the way?
I want to say the 37th, but not quite sure.
All right. You can find out what regiment he was with on something called the Civil War Soldiers and Sailors System. Put in his last name, put in Union. That's a government website through the National Park Service, the CWSS, and you can find out exactly what Illinois regiment he did. And with that, there is a synopsis of what that regiment was involved in, what brigades they were with, where they traveled, where they fought. And you can find out when he joined up through that same system.
Yes, and
at the same time. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you can do that on the Illinois website, so I do know what regiment he was at. I'm just not recalling right now.
But you're interested in then in just the battlefields that the battles that she was involved in?
Well, I'm wondering what avenue she would have taken as a volunteer nurse.
I address that to a certain extent in the book on top 10 heroines of the Civil War because the vast majority of them were nurses, and the Northerners were far more open to the idea of volunteers. Southerners shirked the idea. The majority of Southern nurses were actually male slaves. But the North, by 1863, realized a lack of manpower, if you will, and Abraham Lincoln himself almost called them a fifth wheel, but realized, by way of volunteer organizations, I would look into, there's a book called Doctors in Blue by Adams that does have tertiary elements on nursing, may even mention the 37th Illinois. Okay. There's also a great deal of new works, an older work called Gangrene and Glory that talks about medicine during the Civil War, indirectly talks about nurses. But I would find out about that regiment. If you can find out about the regiment, you will find out where she went, mm-hmm. and what their supply system was like. Because, again, doctors were attached to regiments, and nurses were attached to regiments. Ironically, a northern regiment at its peak strength was about 1,000. And initially they assumed that one doctor and two assistants would be enough. So, dig further into it, but the method by way to do it is find out where the regiment went, and you'll find out where she went.
Thank you, Glady, for calling. Lisa in Sun Prairie, we're on to you now. Hi.
Hello, Tom and Larry. This is Lisa. I have a question about the medical procedure My great-grandfather had his arm amputated in the Battle of Bentonville in April, 11 days before the war ended. And I was wondering if he had, what the procedure is. Did he have it removed on the field, or did he run back to Pratushine on a train?
Hmm. A great example. More than likely, it was at a field hospital set up very, very quickly. Doctors found out by 1865 that if you operated within 24 hours, the patient had a 75% chance of living. If you waited 48 hours, flip a coin. If you waited more than 3 days, the person was almost assuredly dead. So more than likely, there was a temporary site. Oftentimes, they would be large tent areas. They need the light and the fresh air to work in these areas. Sometimes it would be a large house. Oftentimes, churches would work extremely well because they had pews where you could lay the wounded, and you had very large windows and open doors where the doctors could work in light. Now, the procedure, there is this myth, a myth that oftentimes amputations were done while the patient was quite alive. Well, that isn't true. We get this image from a scene from Gone with the Wind, a scene from Horse Soldiers, a scene from Glory. This is not true. In the 1840s, medicine had discovered both chloroform and ether, and both sides had ample amounts of it. When they ran out, they used opium, and if they ran out of that, they might try alcohol, but if they ran out of that, they didn't try. It involved, and we're going to have to be a little graphic here, I hope nobody's eating lunch, it involved a very intricate system where you found out that the bullets, the very soft lead conical bullets, would shatter everything they hit. And so oftentimes there was nothing to save. The number one surgery during the war was amputation. Over 60,000 performed. And when it happened, they'd find out they'd have to save as much skin as humanly possible. That was step one, because that was going to be your living bandage. They'd pull the skin back. They'd carve away the destroyed muscles. Then they'd find the major arteries. They'd suture those arteries shut. Then they would take the stereotypical bone saw and go through that very quickly. But even then, they would take a file and file down the rough edges of the bone. And when that was all over, they would use that skin to sew over the end of the limb. And remarkably, these doctors could do it within about 15 minutes. Wow. And when they did, in an age before germ theory, the majority of these men lived.
Fascinating.
He lived and he had 11 children.
Wow. John Bell Hood, a 33-year-old man who led the fateful Battle of Franklin, where I now live, he survived the war, he survived an amputation, and he had 11 kids, so it's amazing.
Thank you very much, Lisa, for calling. Dave and Augusta up next. Dave, hello.
Hi, interesting program. I became interested in the Civil War when I was helping restoring a home in Sun Prairie called the Charles Cross Home. Charles Cross left Sun Prairie to become a surgeon during the Civil War. I'm really interested in the history of that. Two-part question. First part, do you have the date or the year when the last Civil War veteran passed away? I think I heard it was 1957, but I'm not sure on that. Second question, then I'll hang up and listen to the remarks. Are we losing over an acre a day of historic battlefield?
On the first question, there has been arguments left and right, and I kind of stay out of it. My argument on that one is that the war continues to linger, not because of the emotional issue, but because there's so much of it still left with us. For example, the IRS was invented during the war. The idea of a transcontinental railroad was finally begun during the war. Land-grant colleges were formed during the war, and I'm a graduate of one of those. So we live around the Civil War all day, every day. And so I don't get into the argument which one's the last one to die, because I think it still lives on. I know that's a bit of a poor answer, but it's the best I'm going to do.
Probably in the 50s, probably in the 1950s.
Yeah, it was. Many of these, the fascinating thing, over 18,000 veterans of the Civil War, when the war ended, were 18 or younger. Tens of thousands actually joined up and lied about their age. But as far as about losing an acre a day, I don't know about that, but the fight continues. There was a congressional task force formed in 1991, I believe, of some of the biggest names, James McPherson and Ed Barrs and Ken Burns. And Congress told them, go find out the status of of Civil War battlefields, and they came back to Congress and said, a third of them are gone. We can't get them back. But day by day, foot by foot, we're gaining ground. Where I live, Franklin, Tennessee, and I invite you to join, invite you to come and visit, they had just acquired over 100 acres on the eastern part of the battlefield. We are trying to buy, for the price of $1.8 million, about a half acre in downtown where the worst of the fighting took place. So by inches and by acres, we're fighting back. Preservation with the sesquicentennial is doing very well. But the difficult part is people continually want to erase all of this. This is our national story. And as just as we were discussing earlier, you can't really understand when we were truly divided unless you go to one of these places.
Oh. Joy in Madison has a question for you. Joy, hello.
Hi. I have maybe a slightly different opinion about Gettysburg. I'd only been to a few places, Gettysburg, Antietam, Vicksburg, and Harper's Ferry. And I found, personally, I found Gettysburg to be grotesque. The competition of who could put up the gaudiest, curlicued Victorian monument in these fields, it totally distracted from the sense of being in a historic area. Whereas Antietam was very meaningful because it's very natural, very preserved, and you could soak in the sense of horror and sadness of all the death that had happened there. Now, I'm wondering what historically allowed Gettysburg to become that developed and Antietam not.
That's a great question. I also co-wrote a book on Gettysburg. You might want to look at it, but thank you, Joy, for mentioning that, because when you look at monuments, and they're not that many, made by the veterans themselves, they're oftentimes subtle. They tend to be hidden within the woods where the men were fighting. They tend to be very, very heavy and grounded, and on their faces they would list almost invariably the number of their fellow veterans who had died at that battle. After the war was over and the sons and daughters and grandsons and daughters got a hold of the stories, they glorified the war. Those monumental, grotesque Victorian things you're talking about, those were testimonials of people who were never there, who want to romanticize the whole event. And we still run into people like that. One of the reasons why Gettysburg got that way, ironically, is that then and now, Northerners consider that to be a great victory on their soil. Even the victorious general, George Gordon Meade, said, "We have driven the enemy from our soil," and Lincoln just lost it because he said, "Don't you understand? The whole country is our soil." But Gettysburg grew to be the grotesque thing it did because Northerners were so angry about the war, especially the sons and daughters, that they elevated it to be far beyond what it was ever supposed to be. And some of those monuments ended up being rather offensive to the veterans themselves. That's a great point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Still, I recommend it. I recommend going there, sitting on Little Round Top and some of the other places, and actually walking the battle. I think it's well worth the trip. I think it is.
Sure. And can I just interject quickly? I encourage every person from Wisconsin to go down to Vicksburg, just as Joy was saying. That is a phenomenal place. 9,000 Wisconsin soldiers fought there. And indeed, that was arguably a much, much bigger victory for the Union than Gettysburg ever was.
Yeah. We have Martin in Dodgeville. Martin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi. How are you? This is, intriguing, as most things about the Civil War are to various people. But actually, I listened before to this woman who was trying to find out her nurse heritage, etc. And most of that information is really available on the Internet. If you have, for instance, the regiment number, even a name, perhaps, if you Google that stuff, you'll find a great deal of research information, including even Wikipedia, which is, marginal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even the last 10 years have been a heaven sent to research altogether in history because of the Internet. Some people loathe it. I happen to love it. You're totally right, Martin. It is a great tool to use.
And we've got to thank you for calling. Fred from La Crosse says there is still the son of a Union veteran alive in Wisconsin, Willie Upham Jr.
Yes, yes. There was a recent book done out of Quincy, Illinois, about real sons, if you will. There's 18 still alive that I know of. And two, came down, one from the north, one from the south, down to Franklin, Tennessee to bury an unknown soldier in 2009. And again, exactly as Betty was talking a long time ago, what happened was so many men joined up very, very young in the Civil War. And especially for the North, in the 1880s and 90s, it was very popular for politicians to give them pretty good pensions for the war. And so these old men suddenly found very young female callers for the financial security. It wasn't that much money, but at the time, we were going
enough.
To. Yeah, it was enough.
Oh, Thomas, this has been great fun, and thank you so much for writing this book. I'm enjoying it very much, and I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Me too. Thank you so much. And I might give a plug to Cambridge Heritage Day coming up on May 14th. I'm going to be speaking there, and it's their first annual dedication to the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. So Cambridge, this Saturday, please come. They're working very hard on it, and I'm excited to be there.
Oh, thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Yeah, thank you. Thomas Flagle, Assistant Professor of History at Columbia State Community College in Franklin, and author of Franklin, Tennessee, that is, an author of The History Buff's Guide to the Civil War, the top 10 rankings of the best, worst, largest, and most lethal people and events of the Civil War. Great reading. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.